You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me is Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad. How's it going?
Neil's a sports writer at 538 and also a man with a bit of a cold. Is that right, Neil?
Yeah, I might sound a bit different this week. It's up to the listeners to decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
You're going to get some good emails after this. And then all the way in Canada, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Kate, can you hear me all the way on the other side of the border?
Hi, Chad. I can hear you.
Wow, technology. Who knew the Canadians had it? Kate, you're there for the World Cup. Is that right?
Yep. I'm out in Vancouver. Had the pleasure of watching Cameroon, Ecuador last night, and then Switzerland, Japan.
Excellent. Were they fun?
Yeah. The second match was quality. The first one, Cameroon, as predicted, ran away with it 6-0.
And it seems like Vancouver's had the best attendance so far of any of the sites. Is that right?
Well, I think save for the U.S. match, which attendance was great in Winnipeg. Yeah, like last night, I think the announced attendance was about 25,000, and most of that was for the second match. Like at the start of the Cameroon-Ecuador game, I took a bunch of pictures and like video on my phone, like as the flags were being walked out. I mean, you could hear what people were saying on the lower level, and I was up in media on the top. So there weren't a lot of people there then, but it was a 4 p.m. start. And the place got packed by the time what you would consider the marquee match, Japan-Switzerland, started.
So we're going to talk more about the World Cup on today's show. Before that, we'll also talk about a gloriously messy NBA Finals. We'll bow down to Serena Williams. Then we'll talk World Cup. And then to close the show, Nate Silver will debate NBA dynasties with a 12-year-old. As any hot takedown should end. But first to the NBA Finals, which have been a riveting, sloppy, glorious celebration of basketball, old and new. The Cavs have seemingly run enough isolation plays to somehow take two games to overtime and win one of them. And I think we'll talk a little more about the ISO strategy that they've been employing. LeBron has been at the center of nearly everything the Cavs have done since Kyrie Irving especially fractured his kneecap at the end of Game 1. In Game 2, LeBron went 11 of 35 from the field, scoring 39 points. But that wasn't enough for our old friend Skip Bayless on First Take.
Your man, LeBron James, the man you call, and I agree, is the best player on the planet, a C-plus for what he did last night. I set my bar high. And I'm here to tell you that occasionally LeBron's overall numbers, which look sensational once again because they add up to a triple-double, can camouflage what really happened.
C plus. So, Neil, while you were watching that game, were you thinking C plus? Or, alternatively, the stats suggested he's C plus?
No, I was definitely not thinking C plus when I saw that game by LeBron. Now, I don't want to play devil's advocate on behalf of Skip Bayless ever, but in this case, you can kind of see where he's coming from to say that you would lower the grade from the A-plus that I think you would immediately see these numbers and think 39 points, 16 rebounds, 11 assists in a finals game that was really an important game for them to win. They took back home court advantage. That seems to be like an A-plus performance, but then you also see the efficiency numbers. He shot 32% from the floor in that game. He's not having a good series from a shooting efficiency standpoint. So if there's any criticism to be had of LeBron, I think that would be the only area in which Skip could build his case off of. But like you also said, everything is going through LeBron James in that game, and I think it's the testament to what an extreme outlier of a talent LeBron James is. in the sense that he's capable of having these types of games. Who else in the world is able to shoot 32% but still seem like and feel like and by the plus minus numbers when he's on the court be the most crucial player to his team in every possible facet of the game? It seems like LeBron James is basically the only player who's capable of being that. Even at his worst, from an efficiency standpoint, he is far and away the most important player and then the player that you have to watch every time Cleveland comes down the floor.
Kate, is it fair to expect LeBron to be super efficient and super used? His usage rate was somewhere in the 40%. And so, I mean, one's efficiency is going to go down if you're taking more shots, right?
I think the efficiency standards we have, you kind of have to throw them out the window when you look at what LeBron's doing specifically in this NBA Finals, because it's almost like a car engine or something, or like a truck towing something. That's how I think of LeBron in these NBA Finals. You can't hold him to the same efficiency standard you might at various times when he was playing for the Heat, or if he had other players whose engines seemed to operate outside of his own, because what LeBron is doing here is he's siphoning off so much of his own efficiency in order to create chances and also get the most out of his teammates. So I struggle to apply the same grading standards to LeBron when you look at his shooting percentages or his specifically his efficiency in this series because of that. Because the whole point that the Cleveland Cavaliers have made it to this point and may are even competing with the Warriors is because you have no concept of how his role players, his quote-unquote LeBrons, how the role players are going to perform when they get plugged into the LeBron engine. Like, there's no formula there to say, well, this is what J.R. Smith's going to bring, or this is what Mozgov's going to bring, or any one of those guys, because it's like every time they plug into that LeBron hub, you see a different current flowing through them. So I'm going to excuse LeBron James if he has a low shooting percentage, or if you could say his efficiency is lower, because all of that fuel is being poured out and siphoned off to make like the sum of
so
the
much
parts
in this metaphor
higher.
Right, and what does it say about LeBron and his track record that we would even begin to expect something approaching even like average efficiency given the workload that he's having to take on for this team? I looked at another series that LeBron had just to kind of show you that maybe this is the standard that Skip Bayless would hold him to. In the 2009 Eastern Conference Finals, which is a series, by the way, that the Cavaliers lost, but it wasn't LeBron James's fault, he had a true shooting percentage of 59%. League average is around like 50%, maybe a hair over that. And his usage rate was 39% in that series. So he took 39% of the possessions for the Cavs when he was on the floor. In this series, in particular, against Golden State, his usage has been 43%, and he only has a true shooting percentage in like below 40%. So if we're holding him to the standards of the 2009 Eastern Conference Finals, which may have been the best single performance by an individual player in a loss, if not in any type of series in recent memory, then yeah, he's falling short of that. But it also speaks a lot to the standard that he set up for himself, that we would say, look at these numbers that he's putting up now in the NBA Finals and think that that is somehow less than, you know, outstanding.
Well, and he's 6 years older, and I think
that's,
you know,
right,
we should take that into account. And
he's a different player.
Exactly.
He plays a different style.
And what was interesting, Neil, is it seemed to me like they were just running isolation plays for LeBron over and over and over again, especially without Kyrie in the game. But when we looked at the actual numbers of the isolation plays per game in the finals, game one versus game two, there were fewer isolation plays in game two. So the rap on the Cavs and on Blatt and how he's coaching the Cavs is that everything's running through LeBron. They're just clearing the floor for him. But actually what it is maybe his usage rate is really high because he's facilitating. He's basically running the point as a forward.
Yeah, if you looked at almost every possession that the Cavs had when LeBron was on the floor, LeBron was the key decision maker on that possession, and he chose who got the ball, and they ran a lot more pick and rolls, not necessarily isolations, but that's another way in which LeBron is, in fact, even more devastating, giving him the opportunity to kind of make the decisions in real time and decide who gets the ball. And so it seems like there isn't a single shot or possession that takes place on the floor for the Cavaliers that isn't decided by LeBron James in some capacity or another at this point in the finals.
And I think it's worth noting, too, that you see this in the NBA a lot, especially on end of quarter or end of game possessions when they go to much simpler plays that are relying specifically on the talent of their star. And that's because of the practice and the difficulty of like executing really intense plays at the end of a quarter, right? And that's kind of the position the Cavs are in all game long now, because their big three is down to a big one. So would we see a different Cavs team right now in the finals would they be in the finals if they didn't have Kyrie and Kevin Love? Who knows? But we'd see a different Cavs team if they had had time to shape this as their team. But because you've removed two of their three best players, you're kind of seeing the Cavs in like end of quarter mode, but all of the time, because they have to rely on that type of basic play if they want to just get through this series and have a chance to win it.
And it's worth noting that those types of plays at the end of quarters and halves are the least efficient types of plays that you can find. So I think you hit the nail on the head. You talk about that if they're running those types of offenses throughout the entire game, what would you expect them to have efficiency-wise?
Okay, so it seems like we're agreed that circumstance has conspired to create an inefficient but perhaps successful strategy for the Cavs going forward. But there's another team on the other side of this, and it's the Warriors, and they have not looked like the Warriors that we saw run through the Western Conference Finals, at least from the eye test. They have shot 29% from three in the series, and in that game, too, they shot 22%. That's way off their 40% rate this year, and all I can think about while I'm watching them is this something the Cavs are doing, or are they just playing on the low end of what their distribution essentially is, and they're going to regress to the mean? That mean is really good. They're going to blow the Cavs out for the next three games.
That seems like the crucial question of the remainder of
this
series.
You're supposed to have the answer, Neil.
Is whether or not this is kind of a fluke performance. And you saw Golden State miss a lot of open shots, and I think that suggests that those shots will start to go in more. But I think also the Cavaliers are doing some great things defensively, especially on Steph Curry. And if you look at like the way Dellavedova played against him the other night, especially in Game 2, that this may be something that Cleveland can sustain going forward, even I think it's almost certain that they're going to regress toward their much better mean in some capacity.
The other question that seems floating is whether or not the Warriors' strategy in particular is geared to go cold every now and then. Our colleague and our chief hockey correspondent, Nate Silver, took a break from hockey to write a piece wondering whether or not a team that thrives on the three-pointer, that you live by the three-pointer and you die by the three-pointer. And what he found was that, first of all, the Warriors are not this three-point outlier within the league, like sometimes they're made out to be. They took the seventh most threes in the league, attempted threes, and that there's no bearing on success if you rely on three-pointers for your points or if you don't. That there is no such thing as the hot and cold. You can go hot and cold, but that you'd go hot and cold the same way other teams would go hot and cold, essentially.
And I find that really interesting, having been a three-point shooter growing up and constantly hearing the phrase live by the three, die by the three, and kind of getting to a place where I believed it. So I was really interested to read Nate's specific take that you're not more likely as a three-point shooting team to have these bouts of coldness. But I think that what I found most interesting is that really the idea is not just about three-point shooting, but it's about whether you take away a team's best weapon. And as one astute commenter noted on Nate's piece, we say live by the three, die by the three, but you wouldn't say live by the rebounding, die by the rebounding, because there's this inherent assumption that rebounding isn't random, that it's effort, whereas three-point shooting has more randomness because of the percentages attached to it, maybe the difficulty level that we attach to that particular skill. But at the same time, if you look at the one Warriors loss where they shot really poorly from the corner, in a lot of ways that's the bounce of the ball. And that can happen with rebounding too. There are times when rebounding teams are going to have poor rebounding nights because it's the angle you take to get the rebound ends up not being the right angle. And Neil, you end up in this place where you just are never getting the ball that night, despite the same level of effort.
Neil, is that the case? Do you know if the bounce of the ball affects certain things on the box score more than others? Like, does rebounding, is it?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't think I've seen any research on that. You would think, like you said, Kate, that certain attributes of a team would make them consistently able to rebound and perhaps even like defend the post or something like that, because size doesn't change. Effort, you would think, given a player and a certain coach coaching him, wouldn't really change that much, given especially the stakes at hand here. Whereas shooting, it feels different. I think we've done a lot of these hot hand studies that can't really decide whether, yeah, and they can't really decide, well, is there a hot hand, is there not? We there's something statistical and inherently random that even people that don't necessarily view sports through that prism accept about shooting that they just don't tend to accept about other facets of the game.
Okay, guys, so let's...
Isn't there, sorry to add one more thing, like we talked about last week, we talked about baseball and how when you remove luck, which is when, you know, you were saying, like, hitters would get multiple hits in a row, therefore produce more runs as opposed to, like, scattering mm-hmm. hits. I mean, this looks like there's an element of that to me in three-point shooting. Like, the Golden State Warriors, there's an element to luck about who's going to have an off night on what night. And when the off nights align, you're going to see the Warriors lose. But there's an element of luck to how many guys are going to have an off night at once, because the Warriors consistently win and their percentages maintain even when some guys have an off night because other guys are having standard nights. I think what we're seeing right now is a stretch of bad luck in that guys are having off nights stacked on top of each other.
Right. What I guess will be interesting to see is whether or not that is because of a team defense from the Cavs or whether or not it is the sort of random event where they all have bad luck at once.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, the Warriors are almost going to have to win this series to disprove this and maybe put a stake in the heart of this idea that you can really plague like the run-and-gun Suns and a lot of other teams in the history of basketball where there's this kind of ugly myth about, you know, three-point shooting teams can't win. I think the Warriors are carrying the banner for that team, you know, that type of team, and they're going to have to win this to put to death that myth.
Okay, guys, let's leave it there. I'm sure we'll end up talking about the finals again. And now, a message from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. People of Cleveland, are you still searching for tickets to Game 3 of the NBA Finals? Because SeatGeek has them for you. And even though they cost $656 each, that's the cheapest that I found, they're still a pretty good deal. And I know that because they got an 80 deal score in SeatGeek's fancy deal algorithm, which takes into account historical ticket prices, the magnitude of the event, all sorts of other stuff. And maybe that deal's not good enough for you, or maybe you don't have $650 lying around. There's an even better deal across town at Progressive Field. $9 to watch the Indians play the Mariners, but most importantly, a 96 deal score approaching the perfect deal. And wait, maybe I just discovered a loophole, because using the promo code TAKEDOWN when you're buying a ticket on the SeatGeek app, gets you a $20 rebate. So if you're buying a $9 ticket and you use promo code TAKEDOWN, maybe I just found you 11 free dollars. So try it out. Tell me if it works. Whether for the Indians game or some other cheap ticket on SeatGeek, all you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek is going to send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this spring. Serena Williams won her 20th Grand Slam in Paris over the weekend, giving her more than any man and as many as all but two women, depending on how you count Grand Slam championships. She'll need two more to catch Steffi Graf, and at that point she'll have a good claim on having the most Grand Slam titles ever. Can she do it, though? Here's Serena answering that question after the match.
20 is a lot. I can't believe I've won 20. It's like, it's not real right now.
I have to tell you, only two short of equaling Steffi Graf's record, and then maybe three can become the greatest player of all time. I think that's what you have to look for now.
Okay, so I'm 33. I'll be 34 this year. You know, I got a little time, We'll see.
So that was an interview with Eurosport after she won the French Open. Kate, does she have time? That seems to be, she's sort of in a race against time in a lot of ways, as she tries to keep winning against the competition that just can't seem to keep up.
It really feels like she does have time because of the maturation of her game, and in a lot of ways, like, just overall maturation that we've seen from Serena since she first burst onto the scene. And you can make tons of parallels between the way Serena's game has evolved over time and other generational athletes and how we've seen their games evolve over time. Not necessarily in the tennis world, but if you even look, you know, at Michael Jordan in basketball, the key thing for him to be able to play at such a high level, even as he got older, was, you know, his ability to kind of like work at the elbow and pump fake and get those jumpers off and really evolve his game so he wasn't solely dependent on that kind of amazing athleticism we came to know from him. And in the same way, you can see how Serena has changed her game, and she's certainly still strong and explosive and dynamic, but she also picks her spots. And you can see there's a longevity to the way she's playing now. Even in this great Brian Phillips piece, Brian Phillips for Grantland, he talks about how when she was young, Serena would never give up a point, and she would exhaust a lot of energy trying to win a point that maybe the percentages might say she was a real long shot for. And you see her now, you can almost see the mental calculations she's making about just letting a lot of points go and gathering back energy for points that maybe are right on that 50-50 barrier, rather than trying to go for points that she only has a 12% chance of making. I'm obviously just making up those numbers, but watching an athlete do that suggests to me that there's a maturity and a longevity to their game.
And she said in that interview with Eurosport that it was that because she had been so sick in the French Open leading up to that, she knew going into the game, into the match, that she had to hit winners because she wasn't going to be able to run a bunch of balls down over the next 3 hours or something. That she wanted to go for winners. If there are unforced errors, so be it. But she was trying to win the points when she had that moment to.
Yeah, and I think even health, if we talk about, you know, Michael Jordan and other players as they get older, staying healthy is definitely a skill and something that you can kind of cultivate as you get older, whereas other players at the same age might drop off. You see this a lot, you know, baseball pitchers for sure. And Serena Williams has stayed relatively healthy the past near about 4 years now. And I think that's been really crucial to her because she went through that spell where she missed some Grand Slams.
She had some chronic
and she had some chronic health issues at that time. And so that may have been like a turning point where she could have gone either way, but she has come out even stronger, it seems, and is having one of her best years ever right now.
And to Serena's original question is or wondering whether or not she can get it before age catches up to her. Our colleague Carl Bialik, who's on Hot Takedown either last week or the week before, has shown in numerous works that tennis is getting older and older, that the average age of players in Grand Slam singles tournaments is getting older, that the peak age is getting older. And it seems to me like Serena's not the usual 33-year-old, even within this new landscape of the older tennis. She is so good in the finals of tournaments. She has won 20. She's lost only 4 finals in her entire career. She's been 24 total, which is far less than Steffi Graf. I forget what her ratio was, but Serena has won 83% of her finals. And she plays even better against her rivals and against good competition, which is also not something that happens every time. And then the other thing is that in the women's tennis game right now, the competition is diffuse. That whenever a player seems to be making a run, they don't quite stick around that top 10 the way that perhaps, you know, we'd expect, in the sense that young players come up, they're a rising power, and the way that has happened in the men's game for a long time, Nadal, you know, breaks through at 18 and he sticks around the charts for a while.
Yeah, there seems to be this conception, especially in men's tennis, of like an aging arc, and when Federer's time ends, Nadal's time sort of begins, and it's his turn. And so you would think, oh, when is Serena going to allow some of these younger tennis players to let it be their turn and not her turn? It doesn't seem to be anytime soon, because she's been the number one overall seed in 9 straight Grand Slams. That dates back to the beginning of the 2013 season. So this is at an age in which tennis players traditionally tend to fall off, even by the standards of Carl had done the research on tennis players getting better on both sides. The peak age of a tennis player still is like right after age 25, even though it's increased in recent years. It used to be in the early 20s, if not at age 20. And yet even now, Serena Williams at 33 is by far the most dominant player in the game.
And I think we can all agree that for an athlete, after winning 19 majors, to have the kind of motivation to win 20 is a really special place to be in. And I think Serena is almost an anomaly in the women's tennis world in terms of her dynamic nature in finals and her ability to keep that kind of that gut pursuit of championships for so long. And I think what's interesting to me when I think about Serena is, okay, why does she have that motivation? Because in women's tennis, there seemed to be this natural order going back generations about champions kind of like stepping aside at the end of their careers. And certainly there's other female tennis players who have stacked up all kinds of titles. But there's something different about the space Serena occupies and the motivation that she still has. And to me, it seems like a lot of that comes from so long being seen as an outsider and facing so many struggles within the sport about getting the recognition she deserved as the kind of tennis player she is and getting fans and the tennis community to embrace her. And so much of that is about race. And you can almost see when you watch Serena the motivation she still holds in specifically Grand Slams and finals. And so much of that seems fueled by her place in tennis and how hard she had to fight for it and the place she seems to go to, even in Grand Slam finals still, that makes her want to once again capture that moment and prove all those doubters wrong. And I'm not sure that there's been another tennis player who can really draw from that same motivation pool that we've seen in women's tennis.
Yeah, but I don't know if I quite agree there, or if I'm quite willing to go there, Kate. I mean, maybe that, you know, that fuels her motivation for the first couple Grand Slam tournaments or something. But as you said, 20 is a lot. And I'd encourage listeners to go read our colleague Ben Morris's piece on 538 called Serena Williams is Some Kind of Clutch. Because there does seem to be something about her ability that goes beyond motivation. I mean, this is one of the greatest tennis players that we'll ever see play, whether or not she were black or white or Asian or whatever else.
And it seems to go beyond even like talent, like we're talking about the number one seeds that she has. She has sort of stacked up to be the best player, but as we see with other types of number one seeds, they don't always win. There's that certain amount of variance, and it does tend to come out in these very evenly matched, you know, matches and in clutch situations. And yet she is such an outlier in those types of situations that is almost the key to her winning, is that she exerts her talent, especially so against players that are sort of close to her, poised to be most capable of taking her out.
When you watch Serena, there comes a shift in her. Whether she loses a set and you think, oh, you know, is Serena going to fold right now? And you can see her at moments, and Brian Phillips writes about this, where she kind of goes to a place that other tennis players don't get to, and you can see that in her. So there is a question to ask about whether that's just her internal motivation, whether there's something throughout her tennis career that has to do with external circumstances that have gotten her to that place, or whether no matter what had happened in her tennis career, you know, she would have had that internal fuel. I mean, I think that's an interesting question to ask about Serena.
Yeah, for sure. And you can read that Brian Phillips piece that Kate is mentioning on Grantland. There are a couple of very good ones that he wrote. There was one in 2012 called The Favorite that we all read to prep for this segment. Okay, so let's leave it there. Serena will be back in Wimbledon, and hopefully the U.S. Open, and so I have a feeling we might be talking about her before long yet again. Okay, Allison McCann is here before Significant Digits. We've brought you in, Allison, to talk about the Women's World Cup. Thanks for coming in a little early today.
I know. I've elevated beyond digits to all things World Cup.
Breaking barriers. So the U.S. played its first game of the World Cup on Monday night. It beat Australia 3-1. Behind a couple of goals from Megan Rapinoe. Allison, you and I were going back and forth over IM about whether I pronounced that correctly. Did I?
You did good.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay.
Good emphasis on the Rapinoe, not Rapinoe.
Rapinoe. Okay. So behind a couple of goals from Megan Rapinoe and a few remarkable saves from Hope Solo, the game came within days of new revelations about a domestic violence incident that involved Solo, her half-sister, and her nephew in June of last year. Those revelations by ESPN's Outside the Lines team contradicted Solo's version of events and suggested that Solo was an aggressor in the conflict, that she was intoxicated during the incident, and that she was confrontational with officers upon arrest. Here's Alexi Lalas talking about what the Solo news may mean for the team.
Hope Solo is the best goalkeeper in the world. What she does on the field and what she does off the field are things that we are going to talk about. The women's team came to the realization a long time ago that Hope Solo is going to make news off the field, but they also recognize that she is going to save their butt time and time again on the field. And it is amazing what professional athletes will put up with to have a good player in their midst.
So I think there's a lot packed in there. The first thing I want to try and figure out is whether Hope Solo is really the best keeper in the world. Because, Allison, when you were putting together our Women World Cup probability model, you had a really hard time finding data on teams, let alone players, right? So can we make that argument analytically that she's the best, or is that just based off of like seeing her make incredible saves over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, I think she was phenomenal in last night's game. She had a couple of really, really big saves in the first half, leading to these grand announcements by Alexi Lalas that she is the best keeper in the world. You know, we're seeing some keepers for the very first time this tournament. But I think it is fair to say that Hope Solo is one of the best keepers in the world. I know we wanted to prove this statistically, so we tried to do a little bit of digging, along with the normal caveats that we only had the 2011 World Cup and this current World Cup, which has, you know, she's played in one game to look at. With those two stats, she's had the most saves, the most shots on goal against her, the most shots against her in general, not even on
goal. But she's played more games than many other goalkeepers. Correct. Because the U.S. is so good.
Correct. So, you know, by these minimal metrics, she is a phenomenal keeper. And I think that's part of the reason why a lot of us are wanting to look away from the other things going on with her. But I don't know if it's fair to say that she is actually the best keeper in the world. I would put her up there, though.
I think the question for the U.S. is less whether Hope Solo is the best goalkeeper in the world. And to that, I would say she's at least one of the top two. I think some people would throw out Germany's Nadine Angerer as in competition with Hope Solo for the best in the world. But the question for the U.S. is, who's their number two? And is their number two as talented and capable of even stopping at least a fraction of the shots that Hope Solo gets to? Because the U.S. is dealing with a complete shift in its style of play and moving around so many players to different positions. And that we even saw in the Australia game that their defense right now is one of the main points, the main weaknesses that you could point to say, well, maybe this U.S. team isn't going to go to the places that people think they're going to go to. And so to have Hope Solo back there with the experience and also the ability to stop very difficult shots that I think their number two keeper would not get to, it's a very difficult equation for U.S. soccer, what she means to them on the field and versus everything she brings with her when she goes to a major tournament like this.
Yeah, it seems like kind of the worst possible place where they could have a potential problem and an absence among the starting players. And also thinking about like the sheer volume of shots that she's faced, like you said earlier, Allison, it makes me think that at the very least, even though we can't necessarily compare her straight up to a lot of her contemporaries or peers, we have a lot of evidence on how good she is, at least, and in conjunction with the shots and the types of saves that she made last night, she, you know, is capable of making those saves, you know, with more reliability, you would think, statistically, because of the huge sample that we have on her.
Yeah, and I do think it's really interesting, especially for goalkeeper statistics. I notice a lot of these that we have available to us are about shots on goal and save percentage. And a huge thing, a hugely important thing of goalkeeping is also organizing your defense, being very vocal, being very someone that's willing to come out and punch balls in the air, like all of these things that we don't have any statistics.
The intangible
factors. I wanted to ask about that, though, because so there's all this talk about distractions and whatever. And in my head, at first, I was like, well, even if distractions are real, and I might argue that they're not as far as affecting the performance of the team, that goalkeepers are so isolated that it's not like they wouldn't be able to work well with their teammates or something, the way that if she were a forward, she wouldn't be able to have good communication or something with someone who was upset with her about these allegations or about distracting from the team, let's say. But what you're saying is that goalkeepers are as integrated into the team as any other position would be in the soccer field.
Yeah, I think especially with the back line. I mean, they're one of the few players that is entirely facing forward the whole game. Even, you know, your defenders and your center backs, who most of the game are, they get a long ball played over them, they're turned around, they're facing their own goal. That is very rarely ever happening to a goalkeeper, so it's hugely important to have someone that's looking and seeing what's coming at you, telling you to drop, telling you there's a player behind you. So, I mean, I think that's even one of Hope's biggest strong suit, is that she's extremely vocal and extremely connected with the back line. And I think we saw in when she was absent in January and February, when Ashlyn Harris came in, that she struggled a little bit with this communication. And I don't think she's a inferior goalkeeper in terms of making similar saves. She's also an excellent keeper, but just didn't have that same relationship with the defenders that Hope has.
So before we move on to the rest of the world in the World Cup, I'm curious, Allison, now that the U.S. has played a single game and a bunch of other teams have played a game as well, including the other two teams in their group, Sweden and Nigeria, where do the U.S.'s chances stand to move on to the next round and also win the whole thing?
Yeah, so their chances of advancing from Group D obviously went up with that win, up to 99%, up from 95%. So it is looking very surely that they will at least be moving on to the knockout round. However, I think a lot of people were surprised at how incredible the other Group D game was, Sweden and Nigeria, which ended in a 3-3 tie. Sweden was heavily favored in that game, and we didn't know a ton about Nigeria. They did win the African Nations Tournament this year, and we knew there was a couple standouts, Oshwala, that we're excited to see, but they were phenomenal for me. That team was so exciting. They had so much pace on the wing, and they were down 2-0 at half off of two defensive corner kick errors, and people were kind of being like, oh, this team is disorganized, and, you know, all the hot takes were coming in, and they totally rallied and came back to tie 3-3, and I think they even maybe could have won that game had they had 10-15 more minutes with Sweden. They were just flying at them, and they were so fun to watch.
And Nigeria isn't the only first-time team that's done well. The Netherlands won the first team ever to win a debut in the World Cup or something?
Yeah, and Nigeria is actually not a first-timer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But just not often timer. We usually only see Nigeria at World Cups, so it does feel like a first time every time. But yes, the Netherlands made their debut on Sunday. They won 1-0, and I believe they were the first debutante team, men or women, to win their World Cup opener.
I like debutante team. That's a nice phrase.
Yeah.
Kate, you wrote a piece for ESPNW about the expansion of the field that brought in a lot of these new teams, from 16 teams in the past to 24 now, and you were wondering in it whether or not that might mean that women's soccer as a whole would have more development in it just because 8 more teams were in the World Cup, or if something else was needed after the closing game in July.
Yeah, I went back and forth on a lot of the logic about this because, jumping from 16 teams to 24, a lot of people were saying that, all right, there are 8 new programs who are kind of getting dumped into the deep end, and that's going to cause them to learn how to swim, right? I mean, the exposure of the World Cup, their federations in those countries are going to inherently, if they're going to be on the world stage every 4 years, they're going to have to get better at women's soccer. That's going to be the catalyst that's going to get some of these countries to pay attention to and fund a lot of their women's programs. And then there are other people who are saying that, much like we see in like women's college basketball with UConn and those top heavy programs, that the parity in women's soccer is so poor that it wasn't called for, that it couldn't even sustain the 16 team to have quality matches night in and night out. So extending it to 24 is introducing 8 new teams, and you're going to see blowouts like you saw with Germany in its opening match, just absolutely destroying the Ivory Coast 10-0. So I wanted to look at what was really going to allow these fledgling women's soccer countries to get better on the world stage. And would it be World Cup participation? Because a lot of people will point out that Japan, which won the 2011 World Cup in 1991, they got outscored 12-0 in their 3 group games. In fact, Sweden beat them 8-0. They go home, they get better. And then 20 years later, we see them winning the World Cup. So there's that model. But you can't really compare a team like Ecuador, which I watched last night, to a team like Japan, because Japan has a league and infrastructure, a federation that's going to support women's sports in a way that's comparable with some of the elite programs in the world, whereas there's a lot of other countries that aren't going to have that kind of infrastructure. So I think that there's a middle ground there between whether World Cup participation is going to spark some of these countries to get better, or whether there's a lot that needs to happen at home during those 4 years and the kind of money and infrastructure that's needed to get them to the place where Japan got during that 20-year period.
Yeah, normally you would think that any kind of playoff expansion would automatically make there be more parity just because you're setting up more opportunities for the favorites to lose. So it really does say something if this isn't going to move the needle at all about the level of talent disparity that there is across the world stage.
Yeah, and I guess I would remind anyone of even in things that we think have parity, like a men's World Cup, you'll still see a Germany 7-1 blowout to Brazil. So,
as we know very well.
I think even as teams get better, you'll still see crazy scorelines, and scorelines aren't always a direct result of a team being good or bad. And I think the Nigeria game is a great example of that. I think about that as a growing program, and two goals they conceded were on defensive corner kicks. And as a team that I imagine does not train together as much as the U.S. women's national team, who's in camp together for an entire year, they're going to spend those training sessions on, you know, working on possession and getting to know players, and not how do we defend corner kicks. Like, that's sort of a luxury training session, I guess I'm thinking of. So you see those goals, and I think about, hey, that's a team, what if they have, you know, more time together and more money, then they're going to get better.
So then how
things.
Does a first-time a debutante team, as we would say, like Cameroon, which is a debutante,
yeah,
score six goals and just run the table, it seems. Like, is that a suggestion? Kate, you were at that game, right? Is that a suggestion that that they have progressed beyond? Or, like, how are we supposed to interpret that?
I think we're supposed to interpret it, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, that Ecuador is really bad at soccer right now. I mean, right, like, the backdrop of that Cameroon performance, which, no doubt, they have a couple of strikers. I mean, one of their strikers, I believe, plays in the French league. And so they have a couple of players who have proven their talents on really high levels. But Ecuador, for example, you know, their coach is 26. They started a 16-year-old. They started an 18-year-old. They started a 20-year-old. I mean, that's definitely a program that maybe is going to take this experience and then go home and possibly really grow from it and get better. And we're going to see a stronger Ecuadorian side at the next World Cup. It's really tough to tell right at this moment how good Cameroon's going to be, whether Cameroon is going to be the kind of program that we see Nigeria being, or whether the backdrop of Ecuador was really what sparked them to have that kind of dominating performance.
Yeah, and not to diminish Cameroon's big win. I feel so bad as we just say, like,
we're raining all over their parade.
But yeah, Ecuador is unfortunately our worst team in the model. They have a WSPI rating of the only
women's
team.
Women's Soccer Power Index.
Yes,
rating.
Yes, our Women's Soccer Power Index below 60 right now. They're at 59.0, which the next team above them is Thailand at 67. And so you can see this
big gap.
A big gap. Yeah. You know, most of our teams are usually within 0.1, 0.2. So.
And this is after the blowout?
This
how much did the blowout contribute?
Yeah, how did they drop?
Yeah, is a good question.
They were
too.
In last place still. I think they might have been around 62.0, if I recall. Okay. So, but they have gone down.
I'm rooting for them now. I'm rooting for the Ecuador women to score a goal.
That storyline, a 26-year-old coach. I'm 26. I'm like, I'm not coaching the Ecuador national soccer team.
Maybe you should try
you
out
might
for U.S.
be
national
in
team.
The future.
Okay, so let's leave it there. We will surely talk about Women's World Cup more going forward. And now we're skipping the significant digit, which is how we usually end the show with our own Allison McCann, to instead bring you a special mini interview. So one of our favorite podcasts around the 538 office is the Slate Political Gab Fest, which features John Dickerson, David Plotz, Emily Bazelon, all longtime Slate contributors. And recently on that show, Emily mentioned that 538, specifically the project we did on to find ELO ratings throughout NBA history, was perhaps had a few issues with it. And we'll talk about perhaps why in a second. But Neil, can you just refresh our own and then our listeners' minds about what that ELO project was about?
Sure, yeah. So in the ELO project, we basically looked at the past, you know, half century or more of NBA scores and figured out how strong each team was after every game that they played by taking into account how well they had played recently, who they played against, and a variety of different things, just to get a snapshot of basically how good teams are. And ELO is a thing that we've used in football. We've used it in soccer. It's been used in chess. In fact, it was invented for chess, and it's all about trying to figure out a rating of basically just how good are you in the moment right now.
And we had something like 70,000 games in 60 years, and it was a huge, big historical project. And this is how Emily Bazelon mentioned it on Slate Political Gabfest.
On 538, there was a post this week about how to rank sports dynasties that snubbed the 1960s Celtics. My son Simon read this post, decided that the data analytics behind it had some fundamental flaw in it related to something called the ELO factor. God knows what that is. If anyone out there works for 538, Simon wrote you guys an email with his critique and would love, love, love to get a response.
So in the nerdy podcast world, that counts as shots fired. So we did what any self-respecting website would do. We invited Emily's son, Simon, to come to the studios and debate Nate Silver. We found Simon's email, we looked at his data, and we coached him up to go toe-to-toe with Nate. And so what you're about to hear is about 5 minutes of Nate and Simon talking about ELO ratings and dynasties and whether Bill Russell Celtics are indeed, or are not, rather, better than Tim Duncan Spurs. And remember, listeners, perhaps this is the significant digit. Simon is 12 years old. He did skip school to do this, and his mom drove him to the interview.
So Simon, this is radio. People don't have very long memories. Give me the 5-second preview summary of your argument.
I feel that the epitome of a dynasty is winning lots of championships and being the best. And there's no greater example than that in all of sports history, I think, than Bill Russell's Celtics in the 1960s. They won 11 championships in a 13-year span, yeah, including a stretch where they won 8 in a row. And I came up with a different formula for measuring dynasties, and cool, by it, the Celtics, Bulls, and Spurs were all pretty close.
So what's this formula about?
You have to start a dynasty, you have to have two straight 1,600-plus ELO seasons. And your dynasty ends when you have two straight seasons below 1,600.
So it can't just be a one-year wonder kind of fluke.
Yeah, I would also say that my ELO formula, it can account for negative seasons. So if you have an ELO rating of 1550, you get negative 50 points for that season.
Yeah.
But I also decided that there should be a bonus for winning a championship because you've reached the top. So I said that there should be a 100-point bonus for winning a championship, because that vaults you to the next level of competition based on ELO.
I think one thing that ELO would say is that eventually it's kind of like we don't know really, right? If there are only two teams in the league and they play each other all the time, it's like the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Generals, right?
True.
You know, it'd be hard to know whether the Globetrotters are really good or the Generals are really bad. So after a while, ELO would just say, you know what, we know that one team's a lot better than the other, but we don't know how good they are in absolute sense, right? So that's, yeah, I think, kind of part of the crux of the debate here.
One thing that interested me was I wanted to know, in a random situation, what are the odds, like just by random chance, yeah, that a single team would win 11 out of 13 championships in a 10-team league? And the answer I got was 1 in 63 billion.
1 in 63 billion, if you're just drawing lottery balls, yeah, that would come up green again, mm-hmm, and again.
And then I wanted to calculate that for the Spurs, and what I found that was really interesting to me was that it was only 1 in 100,000.
That's still pretty good.
True, but it's a little bit less.
But so for the Spurs, then you're saying out of 30 teams instead.
Yeah, out of 30 teams.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is some good math, right? I guess our argument though was about how much to weight championships versus everything else.
I know, I read your article, and I thought that the idea that a championship in a 10-team league is a third of as good as one in a 30-team league. But, I don't know, to me, I feel that winning a championship, reaching the top, you really, I don't feel that there are better championships than others, to me.
To me, I don't know, do you ever watch like old YouTube clips and stuff?
I have watched some of those, yeah.
To me, more than any other sport, when you go and watch old NBA videos, watch games from the 80s, you're like, wow, I mean, this is fun to watch, but whole different style of competition.
But even though it's a whole different style of competition, I think that the Bill Russell Celtics are better than the Tim Duncan Spurs, but I also think that if they played them in a 7-game series, they would probably get swept.
Probably, I think we agree on that, yeah.
I mean, that's why I don't think just because maybe the quality of the players is higher now today than it was, you can say that some dynasties were fundamentally worse.
All right, you know, I'm going to push back at you a little bit more and say, well, you know, we can debate whether the Celtics were just kind of a product of their era and obviously were great in the clutch but slightly lucky at times, or if they were so far ahead of the pack. If you look at the championship number, like you said, 1 in a billion or roughly, right? You know, what about the fact that these guys weren't always that great in the regular season? They're winning 57 games or 58 games a lot of the time.
Yeah, that is true. They weren't historically dominant in the regular season in a way that the Spurs often were. But I feel that one of the problems with analytics, and I put a lot of stock by analytics, but I also think that it fails to measure certain things, like how much motivation do you have after coming off back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back titles. Like, you've just won 7 in a row.
All right, so let's say we can have a debate between the Bulls, the Spurs, and the 60s Celtics. Is there a team you prefer just sort of aesthetically? You put the pictures up on the wall and you say, this is the dynasty that I would want to emulate if I had a franchise?
Well, I'm a Celtics fan, so I'm probably a bit biased. No matter what the numbers say to me, I will always pretty much feel that you can't argue with championships. And they had a lot of them.
Yeah. A lot of rings for Bill Russell.
Mm-hmm. More than he could fit in on his hands.
Well, anyway, it's been really fun chatting with you, Simon. I guess we'll take a poll and see who they think won the debate. But I'm not sure we really disagree that much. It seems like the question is, how much should you weight championships versus everything else? How much do you adjust for error? And these are debates that we could have that would go for hours and hours. But
yeah, and there will never really be an answer.
But it's fun talking about them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you for playing hooky. And I really enjoyed having you join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Definitely.
So that's Simon Bazelon, son of Emily Bazelon of Slate and the New York Times, talking with our own Nate Silver. And yeah, be sure to tell us who you think won. Email us, contact@538.com. And be sure to listen to the Slate Political Gab Fest every week, one of my weekly Friday morning listens. And if you have any ideas of your own, you can, of course, contact us at contact@538.com. So that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan all the way in Canada. Kate, what's your next game that you're going to go to?
June 12th. I'm sticking with Group C.
All right.
You got Japan versus Cameroon. So I guess we'll get to see if Cameroon's for real.
And see if those Ecuadorians can really rally.
Yeah.
And thanks, as always, to Neil Payne. You know, persevered through illness.
This was my flu game.
Ooh, I like that. Alison McCann, still in the studio. Thanks, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Our podcast producer is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. Our intern, guys, we have an intern. It's Asa Chaturvedi. Once again, thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show. Please remember to use the promo code TAKEDOWN when buying tickets on the SeatGeek app. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to leave a review, rate the show. It helps others discover the program on those sports podcast charts. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.